Hello, you're listening to Flix West Canada, but today we'll be talking about a filmmaker from Australia. And joining me is returning guest Burton Fisher. Thank you for coming on again.
Oh, my pleasure.
And I'm excited to be speaking with you about filmmaker Peter Weir. And he's somebody who people might know more from his Hollywood work, but I think I really became interested in his films after going back and seeing some of his Australian films, Picnic at Hanging Rock and Last Wave mostly. But how were you introduced to his work?
My parents actually took me to those Australian films when I think, not all of them, they took me to Last Wave and Gallipoli when I was, think I was like 11 or 12. And I really, you know, it was kind of like them taking me to a fancy restaurant. I wasn't really able to appreciate how great they were. I remember in Last Wave, I thought the death stick was really cool. And and I remember in Gallipoli being really taken by the battle in the end, but maybe kind of bored at the beginning. So I didn't really encounter him again in kind of a positive way until I saw, I think, Fearless in the mid-90s.
Right.
And as both a big Jeff Bridges fan and a fan of existential films, the film just really blew me away. It really kind of took me places. It was, you know, it kind of had a fairly Hollywood structure and Hollywood stars. You know, it wasn't a quote unquote art house movie. And yet it really took me places that those films did.
Right.
And then I think, you know, flash maybe like 6 years forward when I was in grad school, I saw Truman Show and it had the same effect. I mean, it was a quote unquote Hollywood movie, you know, with a big star, Jim Carrey, and it was addressing, you know, real, like real world television. And, but it had the same effect. I was really blown away. So, really, in like the last 10, 12 years, I've kind of gone back and back again to those Weir films, the Australian ones. And it's really like, it's like going now to a fancy restaurant and really being able to appreciate it. Except Weir's better than fancy because he takes you kind of beyond that.
Right. I completely agree. I think I probably saw Fearless maybe early 2000s. For me, it was one of those video store discoveries, and I had much the same experience. And, you know, it's rare to see an idea of a Hollywood film that's very nuanced drama. I think that's something that's a little bit missing in the current Hollywood landscape.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of the reason why he maybe doesn't get the recognition he deserves from, you know, some academicians and some cineasts, because it doesn't, his films don't yell art house. Mm-hmm. And they're not, you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock, I guess, would probably go to the abstract end, but they're very story-oriented. They're story-oriented, and they're very accessible at a surface level. But the spiritual aspect, and not the religious, but the spiritual aspect of his films and the kind of deep elements are things that really do demand that people look close. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think they do have that. And I think that's something actually that's valuable. I mean, I do appreciate abstract films. You know, I love what Carruth, I've told you many times, with abstract, with Upstream Color. But I think it takes a skill to put a story together and also a real character, you know, a character that's not just a symbol, and get something spiritual and something mystical out of it.
Mm-hmm. I think in those Australian films, especially Picnic at Hanging Rock and Last Wave, those sorts of abstractions and spiritual themes are maybe closest to the surface. I think Weir described Last Wave as his messiest film, and I think I wouldn't consider that a problem. I think one of its appeals is that messiness that maybe disappeared a little bit from his Hollywood films. But it's interesting to see how he still brings those abstractions and spiritual themes into the Hollywood films. Something like Fearless, if you look at it on paper, it would sound like maybe a very overwrought drama. And you start looking at all the creative decisions that went into it that I think really elevate it, or at least turn it into the story that it should be. I think it's a great film, and you know, even from the opening scene, the choice of not showing the plane crash, you know, that seems like something most filmmakers wouldn't be able to resist. Instead, you have that very eerie opening with the atonal music and Jeff Bridges walking out of a field with a baby, I believe, and holding a child's hand that he's rescued. And only after a few minutes does it become clear that they've survived a plane crash. I thought, like, that's such a surprising way to begin that film. Or it's not like the typical Hollywood character arc where you would expect a scene to come before the plane crash to set up who he is before this big inciting incident that changes his life, changes his psyche. Instead, you're left to do a little bit of detective work as the story goes along to put together who this person was beforehand. He makes audiences work, which is something I appreciate. You have to work to figure out even just the point of view of the films. I feel like he doesn't feed to you necessarily how you should feel at a given moment, or who's right or wrong in certain situations, or even that there is a right or wrong. I think there's a line in Year of Living Dangerously where they say something like, oh, it's a Western thought that everything has to be good or bad, right and wrong. You know, so watching a film like Fearless, you know, is it what is his behavior maybe good for Rosie Perez's character, but bad for himself? You have to, I think, work to just figure out the moral landscape, psychological landscape, the spiritual healing and damaging that's on display. It's not stated to you in an explicit way. You know, on one hand, the character seems very zen-like, and he's just had his eyes opened, and it's this life-changing experience. And then as it goes on, you start to think, well, maybe he's kind of a jerk, you know, towards his wife, and maybe this wasn't such a good thing for him after all.
Oh, yeah, there are a few of those jerk moments. mean, yeah, he's not a... I mean, you're right, he's a sympathetic character to the point that we follow him, and we're fascinated by him. But, you know, you're right, the moment he's completely disregarding of his wife very early. Mm-hmm. He spends all this time with that boy from the airplane, but he doesn't spend it with his son. And, you know, when he slaps John Turturro, I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, he does a lot of things that really, and it says a lot about Bridges too, who's so brilliant in this, that you're right, we never feel, in the same way we don't feel settled in what spiritual element's going, we don't ever feel fully settled with this guy.
You know, right.
It's like riding a ride that is constantly creaking off the rails. You know, we're not quite sure if we're safe with him. And I think that's really brilliant.
I think it helps a lot that Bridges has that natural laid-back quality. I don't know how willing we'd be to go along with this character otherwise. Or, you know, if another actor was cast, how well that would work, or maybe even if at all. I think that natural laid-backness feeds into the character's detachment from reality. And then you start to see how anytime somebody tries to remind him that he's alive, he kind of rejects that and needs that thrill of the near-death moment again.
Yeah, no, completely. And I guess I'm going to go forward, like, if I almost feel like I'm robbing... I mean, I don't think I'm robbing viewers of this, because if they have not seen this and they see this, my interpretation won't keep them from having their own. But yeah, you definitely do see that at the end he is kind of traumatized, and mm-hmm. that this view he has of, you know, having kind of become bigger than God or whatever God could be. Mm-hmm. The more we find out about, like, his childhood trauma with his father dying, and the more we find out, you know, about his fear, and then finally when we see all these, you know, the pictures that he's been drawing, you know, we really see that that this has been as much of a spiritual event, it's been a traumatic event. And again, to Weir's credit, he's not going to quite tell you how much of each. And how you see it is kind of how you followed Jeff Bridges throughout this.
I like what the other characters bring to it too, because they seem to be, as much as they have their own psychological depth, they feel like a little bit foils. You know, you have Jeff Bridges, who feels like he's not tethered to the ground at all. He might float away. And then you have Rosie Perez, who's so insular in how she reacts to her trauma, and how the same event create a completely different type of psychological trauma for her. You know, she feels responsible for the death of her infant son. And she's so guilty. I think at one point when she's speaking to Jeff Bridges, she says she lied in confession. She couldn't tell anyone. So his approach, it becomes like a therapy for her. And the John Turturro character, I thought it was interesting when they're in that therapy circle and you have other characters who don't really reappear in the film, but they also sort of express their own traumas and their own reactions to this plane crash. And I think he compares it to people sitting around a fire sharing stories. So even though it's maybe seen as modern psychological methods, I think the story, the film, connects it back to tribal, spiritual sort of thought, which is something I think you see reoccurring in other Weir films as well.
You know, definitely, and you caught on something, because remember in that meeting when Turturro is meeting with all the survivors from the airplane crash, one of the things he says, the problems they had, remember, he says we used to live in tribes. He says we used to live in tribes, and in essence, you know, in America, and I'm, this isn't like a slam on capitalism, just the reality of it, is that we're kind of nuclear family oriented now. You know, we don't have the same strong communal ties all across our culture. And we don't have this kind of shared cultural values that we see in his films, like with the Aborigines and Last Wave. And in a sense, if you look at all the characters, they all kind of have these problems that are oriented to kind of Western culture. You know, Jeff Bridges' problem is he has this kind of hyper-romanticism, this kind of exaggerated view of himself that needs to be brought back. Mm-hmm. As you brought up, you know, Rosie Perez having put her child on the seat when she didn't, and then tied up, and the child dies, she's taught by this, you know, crazy guilt. And Turturro, who's like one of the many director avatars in Weir's films,
yes,
he's very trying hard to control everybody and make things work out, and even he has hubris that he has to work out, and they eventually work it out through their ties to each other, not through just solitary effort.
Right. It's interesting, those character types you've touched on, from even before, when you mentioned the character type of somebody who elevates themselves beyond God in a way that seems very common in Weir's films, but he always sort of rearranges the parts, so it's not like you're ever watching the same character just with different actors or different clothing put in new situations. They really do feel like they have specific psychological makeups. Like for me, probably the most interesting of those types of characters was the one Harrison Ford plays in The Mosquito Coast. That's a
great character.
Yeah, incredible character. Ed, incredible performance. I mean, I feel like I'm somebody who's been a little bit hard on Harrison Ford as an actor, especially in recent years. But this was sort of a good reminder that, you know, he is a very capable actor. And it's sort of an interesting play on the kind of charisma and just trustworthiness of maybe the Indiana Jones character, for instance, this sort of authoritative man who's gonna fight his way through the jungle. It feels a little bit like a play on that in some ways, this very smart man who, you know, feels like America's behind him. It's somebody you see, maybe not to that extent, but you see people a little bit like him in real life, I think. You sort of run into people like that, and it's just sort of taking certain character traits and kind of turning them up to 11 for this character study.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of us, we all work around and we all deal with those kind of alphas, those kind of, you know, grandiose in a way that works, you know, and people follow them, and they're very, like you said, very charismatic. And it was perfect to put Ford in this because he had to be charismatic. And I do think it's his best performance ever. There are lawyers. I don't want to pick on lawyers because everyone does, but there are lawyers like that. There are doctors, there are academics, they're directors. Like, and he's kind of a director avatar too. These people who think that not only are they going to achieve their vision, you know, with no real help, but they're going to control people on the way of it, even their family. And Ford does it in such a way that by the time you don't realize how scary he's become to like half an hour past, he's become scary.
Right. Yeah, like it sort of becomes like a one family cult at a certain point. And as much as they hate him and they know he's wrong and they just still sort of accept what he says and they can't turn against him. Even like it's a script by Paul Schrader, which I think like as much as a Peter Weir film, I also sort of thought of it as a Schrader film. And where I really thought like, oh yeah, this is a Schrader film, it's in the third act after this village that Ford set up that's supposed to be a fresh start burns down. And you feel like most movies, the arc would be, oh, he learned his lesson, you know, he's punished, he's going to go back to civilization as somebody who's been humbled by this experience. But he just doubles down, and it's that sort of destructive obsession that you see in many of Schrader's characters, where I think at one point the narration says that, you know, even Robinson Crusoe got to go home at a certain point. Instead, they're just being dragged further and further into oblivion by this character, you know, and he has this mission of bringing civilization to the jungle, but instead you feel the jungle sort of stripping him of civilization.
I mean, completely, because a lot of, you know, capitalist civilization in America, it's based on, you know, romantic achievement. You know, mm-hmm. when we talk about, you know, the accomplishments of Apple, people say Steve Jobs did it. You know, there's not a notion of all the thousands of engineers and designers and all the people putting the computers together. We think Steve Jobs did it. So there is this kind of encouragement of thinking that way. And I think you're absolutely right. It really is a Schrader film too. But they work together because mm-hmm. what Schrader and Weir have in common is both of them are going to break down that notion. You know,
yes.
Both of them, you know, Schrader being a Calvinist with predestination, for him, the way a person comes to spirituality is realizing they don't have that much control. Mm-hmm. And as we've talked about, you know, that line that Ford says, where he says that the, you know, the natural world is crooked and I wanted straight lines. I mean, that's finally the point he realizes, is that, you know, part of getting more knowledge and part of going forward is the humility of understanding the mystery in front of you and that you don't have full control.
That's a brilliant line, brilliant moment. It's something you see Weir maybe building up to. I think that's very present in Picnic at Hanging Rock. There's even the image of a teacher or chaperone early in the film reading a book about geometry under the shadow of the rock, you know, and you have this image in the book of a right angle triangle, and then you see these shots of the strange outcroppings of the rock, and it's almost the word that comes to mind is non-Euclidean. You know, it just doesn't fit into our idea of right angles and sort of the straightness of modernity.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of say Picnic, I mean, except for the fact that Picnic at the Hanging Rock is like one of the movies where he doesn't like have a central character. I mean, there are like five or six kind of characters working around the center character, Miranda. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, you have the rock and you have these girls going on the vacation there and this mysterious thing. And Miss McCraw, she's kind of interesting because with this, you know, she's obviously very smart with math, but she also seems to have this sense of, she keeps talking about like how old and mysterious the rock is. You know,
yes.
She seems to also have a sense of something beyond the geometry. And mm-hmm. and of course, the fact that Miss McCraw gets taken too with the three girls, it means that she kind of has a connection with that in a sense too.
There's such a intense foreboding, I think, in that first 35-minute chunk of the film. It kind of gets under my skin in a way that many horror films don't or can't. You know, it really does disturb me in ways that are difficult to point into words. This eeriness of walking through the cracks in the rock, it's almost like walking through veins of this living thing. It's become a little bit of a cliche to say like, oh, the environment is a character, the city's a character, the ship is a character, but I think in this case it really feels true that there's something alive and, you know, if not menacing, at least sort of dangerous or
inscrutable,
scary, inscrutable, scary in its inscrutability. Exactly. You know, I think like Picnic at Hanging Rock, something about like the contrast between the Victorian chasteness and this incomprehensible force. Like it almost made me think of H.P. Lovecraft or somebody like that. It's not a horror film. I don't think I could really call it one, but it does scare me.
I think
it's so beautiful, but
I think that's a great comparison. I think and I think the Lovecraft is a great comparison too, because I mean you're right about the foreboding. I don't, you remember like that part really at the beginning when the girls are in the room, and it's very sad. I mean we'll probably talk a little bit about Sarah because Sarah is such a tragic character, but she, like it seems like the other girls, is very taken with Miranda, and Miranda says, "You have to find someone else. I won't be here long. I'll be going soon."
Yes.
And at first, it's kind of like, oh, she's like graduating. But it's very clear that she seemed to kind of have an awareness of what was going to happen.
I think, does she also have a line when they're heading out towards the rock that, all this time, all those millions of years, it's just waiting for us, something like that.
Yeah. And I don't know if she voiced, you know, that line that kind of opens the film, what we see and what we seem are but a dream within a dream. And it seems to be tied to her. And it's very clear that she transfixes Michael, the young Englishman. You know, he is, you know, bewitched by her. You know, the pretty young French teacher, she's bewitched by her too. She calls her like a Botticelli.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very clear that
Botticelli angel. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a Botticelli angel. It's very clear Miranda's almost kind of like this midpoint, this nexus between, as you pointed out, this kind of almost Lovecraftian, we hear about a red cloud.
Yes.
Mystery that seems to take these people away and the real world. So, yeah, it does have that connection.
There's that strange passivity as they're the three girls are walking into the rock deeper and deeper, and the fourth girl is just getting more and more terrified and uncertain, and eventually there's that juxtaposition between just the acceptance or being drawn to it, something that other people are terrified of. You know, it's a little bit like Fearless, the plane crash, all these people terrified, and Jeff Bridges' character when he gets up out of his seat and he's completely without fear. I don't know what it is about that, but it affects me.
No, that's a good parallel. I mean, in a sense, you know, and as you say, what's good about Weir is he doesn't replicate the same scenario and the same spirituality every film. Mm-hmm. And so while there are some similarities, they'll still be a little different. But it is kind of clear that, you know, Bridges, whether he did go somewhere spiritual or he went to a heightened place of his consciousness because he lost his fear, did have this kind of, you know, sublime experience. And it's very clear in this film it's taken even further. And kind of what you pointed out is that one thing that becomes interesting is that the horror for a lot of these people, for the townspeople, for Michael, and then for the girls, remember when they attack Irma, when Irma comes back, and they're all attacking her, going, "Irma, tell us, you know, tell us."
Yes.
They almost tear her apart. Is that sometimes the horror is the unsolvableness of this. That the fact they can't solve this mystery, and, you know, can maybe frustrate the viewer too, is as horrific as maybe what they could imagine behind the rock.
Right. Do you think it would matter if there is no solution, or would you like to think that maybe the author and Weir had some idea of what happened, even if it was never meant to be explained, or is that completely missing the point?
I think that one thing is pointing out, I mean, there are many things in our world that aren't even spiritual, like, you know, why we love somebody, or
yes,
why we're passionate about something, or why we have an artistic desire. We can't fully explain that. I think what he's saying is that the moment you start to move to the point where you start, we talked about this being like a procedural, start treating it like a procedural, start trying to think rationally,
yes,
you've already lost.
Exactly. I think so. I like the one guy who says, "Oh, they probably fell in a hole." That's just him coming up with the simplest explanation for himself. But like, there's no satisfaction at any point. It's just, you know, life, it's full of these incomprehensible things that I think, you know, not everything is solvable. You know, it's too big for us. Like, one of my favorite juxtapositions in the film, in Picnic at Hanging Rock early on, is the ants eating at the picnic, and then once the girls are higher up on the rock, looking back at the people down below and sort of equating them with the ants. You know, it feels almost like maybe less the film Stalker and more the book it's based on, Roadside Picnic, where they make this parallel between, you know, this alien force and human beings being like, you know, ants going over their debris after a roadside picnic and not being able to make sense of it. So, like, it feels almost like the rock, it's that sort of artifact or force that's just
yeah, you know,
beyond our comprehension.
In a sense, we're talking about really, because the rock, as you point out, that's not really, they're not ants, and it's a very kind of individual perspective. One thing both the film and the rock are trying to do, they are trying to kind of make you kind of break out of what you're used to, in the same way that, like, Truman in the Truman Show has to break out what he's been used to. In essence, that part of the thing that can keep us from spirituality is that we can get caught into a very specific way of doing things or a specific way of seeing things, kind of like Miss Appleyard, the headmistress in the school. You know, that this kind of hyper-control and this kind of hyper-rationality is going to keep us from seeing the way things are, or keep us from seeing things that we haven't seen. Kind of like what Billy said in You're Living Dangerously, the unseen is all around us.
Yes.
And we can only see it if we kind of free ourselves from the way we used to originally see things.
Right. It's interesting putting it next to the world Truman lives in the Truman Show, because like that world, everything is explained. You know, if a light falls out of the sky for some reason, it's not a mystery. He's driving down the road, and a few minutes later, it says on the radio, oh, a satellite dropped out of the sky, or something like that. You know, everything in his life is planned out. You know, the love of his life, it's sort of scripted. The actress who's going to be his wife, it's all structured, and that's completely somehow dissatisfying to him. He wants the incomprehensibility of life. He wants to not be the center of the world. You know, we have this it's sort of an unusual arc in that he wants to break away from being the center of the world, right?
There's a general term in existentialism called, like, you know, the notion of authenticity and the authentic life.
Yes.
And, you know, part of the notion of the authentic life, because, you know, Sartre was like a Marxist, was to have a life that was more based on authentic, real connections to people, real connections to culture, real connections to history, and less connection to kind of like the everyday habit that you have, your 9-to-5 work, the ideology. I mean, he gets fed ideology through, like, commercials, and, you know, the movies will tell him.
I love the product placements that are just built into his life. His wife turning and saying how great this product is.
Exactly.
It's funny, but it is kind of like that. It's satirizing something we all experience.
Completely. Yeah, completely, because we get that too. I mean, the movies we see, the TVs we see, they fill us with values too that aren't necessarily real, or they're not necessarily our own. And the notion of the authentic life is to free yourself from that. So, as you said, what he's doing really is a real allegory for what I think we all should do.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily like divorce our wives and go sailing and the thing, but, you know, in a spiritual way.
Right. I think it's in Year of Living Dangerously where Billy says that, you're not quite at home in the world, to Mel Gibson's character. And I sort of thought that's maybe true of many of Weir's characters. You know, they're not at home in this world either. But Truman, he's surrounded by this complete artificial world that's to keep him in place. It's all built for him, and he still doesn't feel like he belongs in it. Which is, so, like, I guess he does fit in with some of these other characters, but it's meant to be a world that is tailored to him. To like, what is it the line Eric Harris says when he's being interviewed? Like, I've given Truman a chance to live a normal life. The world you live in is the sick place.
Yes, and there's something also about we all live in the world we're presented with.
Right. There's a line. I mean, that's that could have easily been a line in Mosquito Coast too. Like the Ed Harris character and Harrison Ford's character are similar in certain ways, in their trying to build something completely artificial and thinking it's perfect and thinking that they can maybe outsmart the natural world and make something more perfect than nature or God's creation in these stories, but ultimately it's a flawed creation.
Yeah, and in many ways that makes Ed Harris, you know, Kristoff, who in a certain sense, as the film's going towards the end, we almost kind of have two heroes both coming to these important awakenings. Because mm-hmm. finally, you know, at the end, you know, Kristoff's kind of so cold and professional through the film, but at the end we see that his personal investment in this control and his personal investment in Truman has controlled him. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way that Truman is freed by getting out of this false world's created, in essence, Kristoff is freed by not having to have this in his life anymore. And in a sense, that makes him a lot like Billy Kwan in The Year of Living Dangerously, with his whole puppet show notion that he can control these people and make them good and do things, and that can make the world a better world. And of course, as we know, as that movie goes forward, he gets broken from that too.
Yes. I think they sort of explicitly point out that he's kind of playing God with the, you know, either the woman and the child he's taking care of, trying to take care of the people around him, or with Mel Gibson and Sigourney Weaver's characters. Like, I think he has that line towards the end, the Billy character, when he says, well, you know, I gave her to her, I gave her to you, I can take her away from you. Like, he's just playing God. But you get the sense that it's coming out of him, maybe feeling sort of powerless in other respects of his life. It's almost like he had to develop this filing system and all his connections with people, all his networking, out of a necessity to, as a coping mechanism, to feel powerful in the face of you know, living in this country where he has no power.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. But I mean, first one, obviously, he's this, you know, he's a little person, you know, in, you know, what is, I think this is 60s early 60s Indonesia.
Yes.
And, yeah. You know, he's a little person, you know, he gets pushed, you know, women don't particularly like him, he doesn't have power. So I think you're absolutely right, that does give him a sense. And I think also that's a thing that a lot of us do who are not in that situation, is that he doesn't seem to be someone who can deal with people deviating from what he wants or expects from them.
Right.
You know, it's like from the moment he meets Guy, you know, Guy's going to be this great hero. And Guy is going to be this great partner and to do everything good. And yes, when Guy betrays Susan, it's kind of a lousy thing. But, you know, he doesn't owe – it's almost like Billy feels he owed him to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us do that.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us do that with the people we have relationships with. So, again, that's another great point about Weir, is that there's not a single movie that I've watched where I felt like, oh, that was – alien for me. I mean, and it wasn't the same thing, but I felt like it was touching something, even if I didn't quite know what it was.
No, yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, these stories, they, you know, if you just summarize some of them, they can sound so alien to our experiences, but you watch and the emotional realities he finds in them aren't alien at all. Like you said, they're very relatable.
Completely. I mean, you know, because it was, you know, I love the way the movie starts with a bunch of kids sitting in a theater, kind of a little, you know, neighborhood homemade theater, watching a puppet show, which automatically is like us. Mm-hmm. And so very much it's like Billy is presenting this puppet show from us. And in a certain sense, you know, he has that quote, you know, puppet shows can show the shadows, or puppets can show the shadows.
Yes.
And I think that's almost like Weir's theme line, because that's kind of what he's doing as a director. Mm-hmm. And I almost think that what Weir feels artistically as a director from this is that he always, when he's making these films, has to himself free himself from control.
I think so. I wonder if that's part of the reason why he seems to take on very different projects. You look at from film to film, there's very little repetition. He seems to throw himself into a new challenge each time. Maybe it keeps him on his toes. I heard him talk a little bit in an interview on YouTube, saying that, well, it's like climbing a mountain, filmmaking. Just because you're an experienced mountain climber doesn't mean that it's not like climbing another mountain. So that was kind of the impression I had.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I think that's really well put. You know, I think because it's true, it's one of the things about, like, if you're going to write something that is, make something that has a kind of suggestion to the sublime, the moment it becomes too structured, the moment it becomes too kind of familiar and understandable to the audience, that sublimity goes away. And since he's working really, you know, with story and with character, which by themselves have very kind of familiar aspects that can familiarize the audience, but he wants to defamiliarize them too, I think in essence he always is trying to do something, as you said, that has a little bit of unknowingness to what he's doing. But to me, I think that's what every artist should do. I think any artist who's kind of making something where they're kind of putting it together as if they've already made a builder's book to make
right.
it, they've lost the artistic aspect. And I think that's also a reason, as you pointed out, that he goes to like very different settings and very different type of stories, because it allows him to not get bogged down.
Like, in my mind, the two that are most similar are Picnic at Hanging Rock and The Last Wave, and they're not similar at all. You know, visually, like Picnic at Hanging Rock, it's so warm, and Last Wave, it's so dark and wet and damp. You know, they have completely different tones. They have everything about them's different. But, you know, it's sort of, like I said earlier, I think maybe a little bit of that messiness that ties them together in my mind.
Yeah, they're very similar. I mean, I guess in my personal taste, and I really, this is not to knock The Last Wave, because I like The Last Wave, but I kind of felt like Picnic Hanging Rock succeeded at more, was what I was talking about, that there was such a fluidity. There was never a point in Picnic Hanging Rock where the viewer can kind of go like, oh, okay, I've got my bearings now.
Yes.
You know, from the music, and actually there's, you know, that very interesting Ascent music by this Australian, I forget his name, Bremen. You know, which that very kind of, you know.
Oh, with the pan flute.
Oh, and the pan flute, which, you know, has a lot of signification, too, that it's always alienating you. I felt that in a sense, and maybe it's because Weir was a lawyer like this character, mm-hmm. that maybe it seemed just a little too, I kind of felt like I got everything down in The Last Wave. And I didn't feel that with Picnic Hanging Rock. And I actually, I don't know if a lot of people would see it, but I saw a lot of similarities in the way he did Picnic Hanging Rock and he did Gallipoli.
Sure. I think if I didn't know, maybe the aside from Last Wave, the other film I could sort of guess was by the same filmmaker was Gallipoli, in that they have a similar sort of interest in a location, a specific location that seems to have something tied to it. Like in Gallipoli, I thought you're almost meant to take, I think, the baggage of knowing what's going to happen while watching the film, even before the tragedy of the battle.
Yes.
There's a kind of built-in melancholy, I think, in it. It is sort of similar to Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yeah, and another thing about, you know, and also we're talking about how Weir starts out with nature.
Yes.
You know, we start out, you know, with this guy Archie, you know, who he runs bare feet, you know, so he's connected to the land. He runs, he's got an Aboriginal friend at the beginning, mm-hmm. and they're tied together by running. And then, you know, he gets this friendship with Gibson, the young Irish Australian. And so it's kind of almost a flip thing with Gallipoli, in that we kind of see in Gallipoli things are kind of, at the beginning, kind of spiritually strong.
Yes.
You know, there's connection to nature, there's connection to the world, people
right.
are friends. And it, as you say, it dreadfully moves towards the world people are usually getting out of by the end of most of his movies. And it's interesting.
They sort of mirror each other structurally.
Yes.
Yeah. The lyricism in Picnic at Hanging Rock, it's one of those things I can't ever get over. Those fades that they use in the editing, where it doesn't quite fade, you know, it sort of starts a fade and then the shot doesn't finish. The overlay fades back out again, you know, and it looks like they're dissolving into the rocks or birds are flying out. You know, it really links those girls with nature in such an interesting way. I think the imagery in Last Wave, as much as it's still dealing with abstractions, it's a little bit more literal in how it presents them. Like, one of my favorite images in Last Wave, it's early on of this man drinking from a water fountain while it's raining, and he's holding up an umbrella, and it's very absurd. You sort of realize how absurd it is, this civilization drinking from a water fountain while you're blocking out rain, the water's all around you. But like, that's a very direct image in what it's communicating. You know, Picnic at Hanging Rock, it's a little bit more elusive. You can sort of feel the ideas slipping through your fingers while you're watching it.
Yeah, like if you think about in Last Wave, and as you say, one thing about Picnic at Hanging Rock is that, you know, there's no particular image, like you said, or shot or music, which suddenly we can get, oh, okay, now I got this. Or kind of like, I got more. As you say, it never kind of moves together into kind of, it's not like a big mess, but it never kind of moves together in kind of an ordered way that we can kind of know more. But like in The Last Wave, he has a dream, kind of a vision about every, you know, where we see everyone drowned. And I just kind of felt like, I don't get the idea that, you know, no one has dreams that literal.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It feels like it's written as a dream sequence.
Exactly. And
yeah.
And it kind of also, I felt like, as opposed to the music in Picnic Hanging Rock, which is kind of disorienting because, except maybe the pan flute kind of gave you an idea, mm-hmm. we're now in pagan land. Kind of like, I felt in a sense, and I'm not, this is a small criticism, I felt using the didgeridoo for every time we were the Aborigines was a little cliched.
Right.
Just a little. And
although it was kind of the most terrifying use of a didgeridoo I've ever heard. But no, I know what you mean. It feels a little bit too obvious maybe in its choice.
Yes. Yes. And I still, I love the movie. It's a beautiful movie, but it's just this, it says a lot about Weir that none of his other films that I put in like the big six, you know, Gallipoli and Fearless and Truman Show and Year of Living Dangerous, none of them I feel have that. I feel like he learned in a sense from that. And I think he even kind of talked about it in a certain way, like you mentioned earlier.
I mean, we were just complimenting how non-templative his films are, but like it does feel a little bit like that idea of the civilized person finding this spiritual inner life of The Last Wave. It's maybe something that's been accomplished more effectively in his other films.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely. I think, you know, part of the thing, as I said, representing spirituality is that you don't have, one of the things is you don't have many metaphors. You have a lot mm-hmm. of metonymy, so that all the images and all the sounds, they all give each other meaning in a kind of a complex way, instead of, ooh, this sound means this, and this right. means that. And as you said, he really avoids that. You know, there will be things like in Gallipoli, like when a lot of the young Irish guys, because a lot of the Australians at that time were, particularly the ones who went off to war, were Irish, and they're playing the cheery song, like The Long Way to Tipperary, and yet, as you pointed out, we know exactly where they're going, mm-hmm. and it's not Tipperary. You know, it's Gallipoli for this awful battle. And
no, they're never coming back, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. It enhances dread in an ironic way, but not a literal way.
Mm-hmm. There are things that they do sort of stick out in my mind a little bit like a thorn in Last Wave, maybe in a good way. I had to message you right away after, near the end, when he goes into his dream space, there's artwork on the cave walls, And I'm somebody who really appreciates and enjoys Mesoamerican artwork, the styles, Aztec, Mayan, Olmec. And right away I recognized like the art in these caves depicting the coming wave, this apocalyptic flood, was not Australian Aborigine. It was Mesoamerican in style. So I thought, oh, did somebody just mess up? Is that lazy production design or somebody didn't do their research? But thinking back, there was a point in the film where he's showing his, the lawyer's showing his family photos going back. I think he says it's his grandmother's grandfather or something like that. There's a photograph in the Aborigine. Charlie asks him what tribe was his ancestor from, and he mentions sort of offhandedly that he came from, I forget if he says if it's South America or...
Yeah, it was South America.
South America. But I sort of wondered if, you know, maybe there was something deliberate in that representation of the lawyer's dream space.
When you pointed it out to me, I kind of want to look at it, and then I looked at the film again. And it did look like it was South American, and it looked like it represented his tribe. And I think part of what – and he was part of – I never could get the sound of the Miracles. Was that what – Mercurials?
Oh, I wouldn't even want to try.
Yeah,
something that Mercurial, something like that. Yeah, this spiritual being. Yeah,
yeah, that was his tribe. And I think what they were kind of saying, I think the Aboriginal thing is that the spirit world encounters the whole world.
Yes,
and I think part of the notion was that Chamberlain's character, the lawyer. And pretty much, I get the sense white, because they were white, the Mercurials in the drawing, that white, the suggestion was that white people had lost their touch to the spirituality. And that he, and even his daughter, who was having like dreams about Christ, were representing that. So I think it really does fit into Weir's thing, because there's nothing particularly anti-religious in Weir's movies.
Probably the closest you can find is maybe in Mosquito Coast might be the closest, but I think that's more, again, just as a foil to the Harrison Ford character. Like the Andre Gregory missionary character, like it's not so much critical as a parallel drawn between Ford's character and him, kind of both in jungle, and like that the Harrison Ford character is critical of the missionaries, and
yes,
you know, telling his children that the you know, the Bible's all lies, and he's very much a atheist because, you know, he's God.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, you know, but you know, but like it's not like, oh, he's gone away from God. Like I don't think it's necessarily saying that he's like, oh, you should go and find God by the end. Like it doesn't feel like that either. Like the mission that they find, where everyone's sitting and watching in the jungle, this television of the sermon, like it seems a little bit absurd, you know. I don't think it's like, oh, he's lost his way from Christianity, so much as it is drawing a parallel between their reasons for being there.
Absolutely. And yeah, as you pointed out with the TV, is the Gregory character was really kind of presented as like kind of a capitalist perversion.
He's good at playing sort of this like faux pious dweeb, like,
yeah, faux pious dweeb. I like that.
I mean, like it's sort of funny, like he was also in Last Temptation of Christ as John the Baptist, right?
I didn't remember that. the only thing I have to note it before we go, the one thing that blew my mind is, I don't know if you remember the guy in Picnic Hanging Rock, Albert, the young Australian stable guy.
The dark-haired one, or
remember the one who finds Irma at the rock?
Yes. Oh,
and
yeah.
He's kind of the muscular, you know, rugged Australian young man. He was the right killer in Wolf Creek.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So
just, I didn't know that.
That but yeah, I didn't know that about John the Baptist. But yeah, I think the main thing, there's nothing, you know, like the way they treated Catholicism in Fearless was both kind of respectful but also skeptical.
Yeah, that's the impression I had.
I really don't feel this kind of strident you know, anti-religious, anti-Christianity thing in Weir. I just think for him, he's not interested in it. He's interested in a kind of spirituality that I think he sees as both above kind of our natural world in a sense that we miss, but it's also rooted in the natural world very strongly. And for him, it just religion isn't that, that's not his study. But it doesn't feel like he's trying to go against it, you know, like Christianity's bad.
I mean, it's interesting too, like the aside from the spiritual aspect, just the way that cultures are represented, how people keep repeating throughout the last wave, there's no tribal aboriginals in the city, there's no aboriginals in the city. You know, in the film there clearly are, but maybe in some ways, like, there's a legacy of colonialism that kind of pops up through his films.
Oh, that's huge. Yeah. I mean, I think it's huge. And I think particularly his Australian films. Mm-hmm.
I mean, just like the strangeness of some of these Victorian looking buildings or people in some of these locations in his films. I mean, I'm thinking mostly of Picnic at Hanging Rock. Just it feels very much like an English school transplanted into the Australian wilderness. I guess, like, you know, there's similar representations of clashing cultures in his other films. Like, even you could say Witness, the difference between the Amish culture and the outsider culture, English culture, you know, it might fit in with that. Not so much the colonialism, but...
Yeah, no, I think that's... I always... Part of me, I have so many problems with Witness.
Right.
I put it in the back of my mind. But I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, one of my main problems with Witness is it starts out really kind of interesting with
The ending kills it.
Yes.
I completely, I know.
It's like, I'd love to see these Amish people and how the boy and the woman dealt mm-hmm. with this cop.
Yes.
You know, because then suddenly this guy comes in and he's a real jerk. And we don't care about him. And then they go off in this very unlikely romance. So I have to stop myself.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, that was definitely there in Witness. And it's something very – it's clearly very interesting to me. And, yeah, in Picnic at Hanging Rock, there was really this artificial – Mrs. Appleyard with that school. And, you know, she has Queen Victoria on the
yes.
and the way they treat Sarah and the students, it's like we still have that old English class awful system. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that in contrast, we've got these male friendships, which is a big thing in Weir. We've got this friendship between this kind of, you know, a bit mamby-pamby English young man and this, you know, this rugged Australian who'd come out of an orphanage, Sarah's brother. And
right.
it's a friendship that people wouldn't have looked well upon back then, but they really mm-hmm. do have a connection. So when they've kind of
you just get a sense of how different they are when they're when the girls are stepping by. And
oh yeah.
I forget what he says exactly. It's something a little bit lewd. And when the English friend kind of calls him on it, he says, well, I say it, you just think it. You know, it's that idea of that sort of Victorian repression that you know, these things are improper to say, but people are still thinking them.
Absolutely.
Like, I think David Bordwell pointed out the eroticism of that shot where, you know, they're in this kind of caterpillar chain doing each other's corsets.
Yes.
And but it's like the sexuality being tightened and repressed and squeezed in, and then, you know, they go to this rock where they can let their hair down and go barefoot, and then you know, there does seem to be some, if not explicitly a sexual component, at least sort of a sensual expression.
Yeah. And then Irma comes back with no underwear,
right?
And,
yes,
and Miss McCraw didn't have any either. So again, like you said, it doesn't necessarily mean anything sexual happened, but
there's that, like, you know, when the headmistress is speaking to, I think it's the policeman, and she asks in a very kind of Victorian way, coded Victorian way, if the girl's still a virgin, and the policeman says, like, yes, I've checked. I thought that was such a strange moment. But
yeah, it was very strange, and it was because it was like, wait a minute, suddenly this doctor who's part of this, was he supposed to do that? You know,
it doesn't sit well with me at all.
Yeah, like, gee, how great was it that she came back? You know, it's like, mm-hmm. and then of course she gets attacked. I think that was a perfect moment that, you know, we see this unknown, and where they vanished was horrible. We have to remember these girls are a pretty horrific, not nightmare all the time, but a pretty problematic situation already.
I mean, I was thinking, like, if you wanted to just contrast how the girls' school is represented with a boys' school, like, you just look at Dead Poets Society, it's like such a flip to the boys' school. And like, even the headmistress, like, you could think of, like, you know, her negative is almost the Robin Williams character in Dead Poets Society, where, like, she there's the girl who is it Sarah who writes the poem, the Ode to St. Valentine's?
Yes.
And then she tries to read it, and the headmistress shuts her down, you know, I think even before she's finished a line. Like, the Robin Williams character in Dead Poets Society seems to be the polar opposite of that.
Yeah, in a sense. In a sense, I think you're right. But one thing I always found odd about that is that, you know, and he's a very bad English teacher, but he's a very bad English teacher. But another thing is, he's talking about, you know, the romantics and how to be a romantic, you know, how great the romantic yeah. poets are. And they read Keats, and they read Byron. And yet, he's got them kind of all ordered, and they did this group, you know? And then mm-hmm. by the end, they're even more regimented in the end because they get up on their desks and they, my captain, which is the complete opposite of what happened to these women. It's right. almost like these guys, their spiritual experience went backwards.
But it is sort of like an interesting difference, like you said, that whether it's deliberate or not, that girls kind of drifting off into the ethereal nature in Picnic at Hanging Rock, and these young men in Dead Poets Society who are going to be the future regimented patriarchs, like that seems to be, you know, maybe woven into just how these young people growing up are represented.
Sure. I mean, it happens at an yeah. early age. I mean, you know, I'm not like a major sociologist or anything, but we do. I mean, our cultures, particularly Western culture, we do raise, even now, boys and girls different, you know, and, mm-hmm. and boys are encouraged a certain behavior and not allowed certain behavior that's like not normal, and vice versa with women. And yeah, as you pointed out, it seems like these women were, in essence, it seems that, though, that I don't want to say that this is just like a female thing, that he's just saying that this is something girls have or that girls are. Mm-hmm. Because the fact that the men, the male has the experience too, is in essence what he's trying to do is kind of deconstruct that kind of binary. That when mm-hmm. you get out into nature, our kind of stereotyped biased notions of male and female, they don't function anymore. And,
right.
Yeah, and that's just an example of like a lot of our things that don't. So yeah, I think he's very good at avoiding that kind of stereotyping.
I was sort of curious too, like about. I mean, it's hard to sing without talking to Australian people, but it seems like Gallipoli as a historical event might have informed Australian cinema in general, or even bigger than that, maybe Australian culture. There's this kind of reoccurring idea in not just Weir's films, but other Australian films, of the kind of tragic, reluctant hero. You know, think of these soldiers in Gallipoli going off to this distant place to fight a war for another country, for England. And you sort of see elements of that kind of crop up. Like, I thought a little bit of the Mel Gibson's character in the Road Warrior films, the Mad Max films, where he's somebody who's not really interested but gets involved with somebody else's fight and suffers, you know, for helping these other people.
Yeah, Gibson had that down. I mean, he had this effortless kind of crankiness that he was able to pull off because there was also, even like in Mad Max, you got to sense mm-hmm. one thing about Gibson, and you got to see like his character in Living Dangerously, is that even when he's kind of a jerk, you always get a sense of empathy. Like, he doesn't like yeah. bullies, he doesn't like cruelty. That seems to be a commonality. But what you were saying about the war thing with Australia, I think that's another way to look at how Weir sets apart from some of his directors. It's similar. Is like, you know, one of my other favorite Australian movies is, you know, Breaker Morant. by Beresford. I mean, it's a fantastic movie. And it is an absolute historical, you know, military courtroom drama. And it's a brilliant
I mean,
that.
It's almost like a, like an Australian Paths of Glory.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like a realist Paths of Glory. And yet, like Paths of Glory, you feel like, oh, God, you know, because we know they're doomed. But I think the big difference is that that's just not a movie I would see we're interested in making.
Right.
You know, he would never want to, and not to take away from Beresford in that movie, because it's a great movie, and he's a great director, but he's just not interested in telling you just a historical story. One thing people forget, every time I hear people talk about Gallipoli, they always talk about the battle, but that battle is like 15 minutes at the end.
Yes.
You know, he used this to tell a spiritual movie, you know, about Australia and about friendship and about the difference between life kind of connected to the world and the spirit, and this what war is presented as very unnatural and very unspirited. So yeah, I think that's a big difference between him, and I think it's the same thing. I think Shepesy and Noyes are also a bit more on the realist side. You know, he probably leans more to like Gillian Armstrong.
Yeah, Gillian Armstrong. Like I was thinking of My Brilliant Career a little bit while watching Picnic at Hanging Rock. You can sort of see some. Maybe some crossover.
Yeah, yeah, and High Tide.
Yeah. High Tide, yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's got, yeah. You could say he's, and I'm getting stereotypical now, but if stereotypical, people say he's almost kind of not a traditional masculine director, you know?
Well, I was going to say, like, Mel Gibson, I think in some ways you can see is, as a filmmaker, is very maybe inspired by Peter Weir. You know, you can see him maybe in certain ways trying to call back on his experiences working on Gallipoli while making, oh God, I'm going to screw up the title right now.
Apocalypto.
Making Hacksaw Ridge. Apocalypto too, you can sort of see certain elements of Weir, but like, I think, you know, to your point, like Mel Gibson's films just feel more macho and less lyrical than Weir's. Like, you know, that just seems to be an extension of their personalities maybe. When you hear them in interviews, but you know, you could see maybe Gibson consciously trying to pull on certain things he might have observed while watching Weir work. But he's a different person, I think.
Yeah, from everyone.
Yeah, he's a very different person.
I do see similarities between him and Weir, much more than George Miller.
Yeah, George Miller is I think if you look at. Maybe George Miller's impact on Mel Gibson as a filmmaker, like it's maybe mostly down to technique.
Yeah, I think in a certain sense you can say that he got a little bit of like the visual storytelling from Miller. But yeah, I think he's much closer to Weir because if you think what he like you said with Apocalypto, with Hacksaw Ridge, with I don't want to go to Passion of the Christ where he messed up, but I think he's trying. he is trying to get us to a higher place with Gibson is. I mean, not higher in the sense of higher, better, probably in his mind, yes, in his Catholic sense, but I think he wants the films he does to move you out in a sense. So I think you could probably see a lot of Weir in Gibson. I never thought of that before now, but yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Also thinking of like other filmmakers who might have been influenced, Take Shelter. Like that almost feels halfway to being a remake of The Last Wave, except instead of spiritual themes, it sort of moves them more into psychological themes. It kind of transplants them.
Yeah, I guess it's really hard for me to figure out how much I like Shape Shelter and how much I like Michael Shannon.
the same problem.
Because he was so amazing in that, and then I don't quite, you know. And also Shea Whigham, I'm a huge Shea Whigham fan who played his friend, that when I went back, thought, you know, it's not that original story. I guess it's interesting. Jeff Nichols is one of those guys. I mean, I enjoy his movies.
He's frustrating, though.
Yeah, and he just, you know, those directors that people say to you how brilliant they are, and you think they're good, but whatever brilliance or master artistry they're talking about, you don't quite see.
Yeah.
And I guess that, with Take Shelter is that, you know, if he didn't have Michael Shannon, you know, I mean, not to knock on Richard Chamberlain, but, you know, Richard Chamberlain was a very limited actor, and Weir did a lot with him. I think that if you had, like, Zac Efron in Take Shelter, and I don't want to trip on Zac Efron, he seems like an okay guy, but I don't think we would have done nearly as well. I mean, that's obvious.
Right.
But what I think the difference is that yeah, I don't think it would have been even that good a movie. So I hope Nichols isn't one of your faves.
Like, I always feel like he just throws something out in his films that kind of sabotages them from being great. You know, like it's kind of a... like his science fiction film, or like he sort
Every
of
Night Special.
Yeah.
yeah. I just had two major problems. One thing is that with Midnight Special, he seemed to forget that there's a difference between having a movie in media res, which most movies do, mm-hmm. and having a movie with no backstory, which is fine too, and having a movie in which he'd done nothing to make you invested in the characters at all, so you're right. not, you don't care. I mean, he's starting off with people driving away in a car and having nothing where you have anything what they've really gone through or how the characters relate. And then I had the problem, talk about the difference between Weir. He has this world, supposedly it's this world where time is going to be different and everything. But so
how he chooses to represent it visually is like the most boring way yes. possible. I know, I know.
And I thought, like, that's not that cool. And no. It's not mysterious. You know, so yeah, I think that's a perfect example where he should have fought. He needed to go see more Weir movies,
right?
And I think it would have been better.
Yeah, to contrast that with something like Fearless, which might be my favorite Weir film. It's always hard to pick because they're all so many of them are great, and they kind of give you different experiences. So it's hard to say that one is better than another because they're giving you something a little bit different. But Fearless starts off so mysteriously with the walking out of the cornfield. And by the end, you know, you care so much about the character, and you care about the characters around him in his life, his wife, and Rosie Perez's character. Like, he, I don't know, it's really quite remarkable, I think, what we accomplished with it.
Oh, definitely. And his wife, to talk about, I mean, to me, if you don't have Isabella Rossellini, and
right.
It was weird. Rosie Perez got the Oscar for that, and I thought Isabella Rossellini was the one who was brilliant.
That character... Easily could have been just the sort of typical, like, shrew. Oh, she doesn't get him. But, like, Weir doesn't play it that way at all. And Rosalini fits so perfectly into that, where, you know, you really do sympathize with her when she's trying to understand what her husband's been through.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah.
And she doesn't play it as a martyr. I think it was good, too. I think you're absolutely right. And she doesn't come off as a martyr either, although, you know, I got to say, I mean, if I was her, I would have kicked him out a long time. But, you know, she doesn't. I think she did a lot to really ground that this was someone who really deeply loved him, was really deeply hurt by him, and was really deeply worried and also about her. And she got all that across, you know, and I thought her thing allowed Bridges to go an awful lot because we felt she was there and she was protecting her kid and also she and you know if she had just been this kind of like oh Jeff do whatever you want and you're not upsetting me that would have been bad too
right
you know
well one of my favorite scenes is between her character and Rosie Perez's character where she's like I think Rosie Perez's character says oh it's not what you think but you know, she assumes the wife's going to think that she's having an affair and it's not that. But, you know, Isabella Rossellini's character knows it's kind of worse because
yes.
he's open with her and not open with the wife character. So it's, you know, it's a little bit more like, you know, not physically cheating. It's emotionally cheating on somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just great, you know. I guess the writer, he never really wrote anything again, Rafael Iglesias. He had a famous article because he wrote an article about why he worked for Roman Polanski, even though he knew about Roman Polanski. But it's a great screenplay. I think what's interesting about, you know, Weir with screenplays, because he writes his own too, is he seems to kind of know. I mean, there are times like Dead Poets Society and Witness where it's just like, hey, I'm here in Hollywood, I'm here to make money, and those were his two biggest money makers.
Yeah, they made Witness was a huge hit. I think, I mean, it's kind of remarkable, something like Dead Poets Society, like that, you know, it made something like 10 times its budget back. It was, you know, an actual big hit.
Oh, it was
you
huge.
Know, so, and it's not like, you know, it's not like an action movie. It's not, you know, it's a ostensibly a drama and crowd pleasing, I guess, so.
It was very sentimental. But yeah, I mean, it did what it, and to be honest, like when people, I say how bad it is, one thing is Weir directed it really well. I mean, it's supposed to be a manipulatively sentimental movie, and he did that perfectly.
No, it's effective.
Yeah,
it's an effective movie. You know, the performance is accomplished. It, or even something like Green Card. I think, like, you know, his objective setting out to make you know, romantic comedy. It's a good romantic comedy. I think it's, you know, maybe not the same sort of artistic film that you can invest in as some of his others, but like, I like Green Card.
Yeah, no, I mean, Green Card's fine. Again, I think that's another one where he didn't even try to make it his movie. He just said, I'm going to make these scripts. But I think with Fearless and Truman Show and the Mosquito Coast, he saw these scripts as scripts that I could do. I mean, not completely take over, but I could do and make it a Weir movie. You know, because Mosquito Coast, even though it's Schrader and Nickel did Truman Show and Iglesias did Fearless, those are all still Weir movies, while Witness, you know, who was written Shock by a guy who wrote for Gunsmoke for 15 years.
it feels like it, yeah.
And then I respect that.
Sure, yeah.
And I can watch Witness and I can do it. I can watch Green Card.
Well, I mean, Truman Show, like, I think that's a very good Jim Carrey performance, but there's a couple of moments when he's sort of shouting, but like I sort of feel like a good Jim Carrey performance, still, maybe there's other actors that could have played it better. You know, for me, like, I'm not a huge fan of his, but
I'd like to hear, maybe not now, maybe I'd like to hear some suggestions. Not that I don't believe you, because I can see that happening.
No.
I thought Carrey, yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, I know you can come up with some. I'm not challenging you to that, but I thought, yeah, I'm not a big Carrey fan at all. I don't think I've ever even liked him. Maybe in Dumb and Dumber, I kind of liked him.
Right.
I kind of liked him in Living Color. But God, I thought he just got that. And it was so hard because he has to be sympathetic. He has to be pathetic. He's got to be heroic. He's got to be comic. It was a very, I thought, difficult thing. The one thing I was thought, you know, I just watching it, I always felt bad, like, the mother. I don't think I ever realized how awful it was that they gave him this overbearing, emasculating mother that wasn't really his.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe the worst thing. And I like my mom, so that's not a real mom.
Well, I was just thinking, like, there were so many films towards the end of the 90s that seemed to be about questioning the nature of our reality. Like, there was Dark City and Fight Club and The Matrix. The Truman Show seemed to fit into that somehow, where, you know, you're meant to question, is this life around us really ours? I wonder what was up with that in the late 90s.
Yeah, there was a lot. 13th Floor is one of my favorites, just to give a plug there. There did seem to be a lot of kind of, and I'll give my literary term, the Borgesian, you know, Jorge Luis Borges, all those kind of levels of reality, and Philip K. Dick. I just think Truman Show is, it's one of those movies that just, you know, it really visual, it realized exactly what it was trying to do.
I mean, whenever there's a film that has some kind of artificial reality or like world inside of a dome, I immediately perk up. You know, I love the moment when it looks like there's just sky in the distance, but then he hits the wall, and that's just the end of that world.
Yeah, you know, that was it was funny because my American history professor was in there, and we just studied Moby Dick. You know, there's that famous line in Moby Dick, who's also a real Gnostic guy who isn't going to accept his world, and he said, you have to strike through the pasteboard mask. And it was, he totally literalized that.
That's a perfect connection. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I saw him, and I kind of, you know, was like, oh, dude, you know.
Well, thank you for joining me to talk about Peter Weir. That was really exciting conversation. I think people are going to really enjoy that. If folks want to follow you on Twitter, where could they find you?
I'm at fisher.burton at twitter.com. Or is that how it works? Yeah. Yeah. And I should be on the site, right? I mean, when this comes out?
Should be, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if folks want to follow me, at Movie Kessler on Twitter, and the show's Twitter is at FlixWise. You can follow us over on FlixWise.com. We're on iTunes, we're on Facebook, all the good stuff. It's FlixWise. You can figure it out. You're a savvy listener. I know you are. So thank you for listening, and take care. Ciao. I'm gonna go get some more.